WLRN.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a look at interpersonal relationships and how some people use dysfunctional relationships to hide from intimacy. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Our guest is practicing psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner. He's written a book on what he terms irrelationships. He asks, why does it take a moment to fall in love but 10 years to get out of it? That's in minutes. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. She'll visit with some local restaurant and craft beer folks to celebrate National Burger Month. Stay with us. Topical Currents up next after a roundup of national and local news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Democratic race for the presidency is playing out in West Virginia today. Bernie Sanders is hoping to pull off another win like he had in Indiana against Hillary Clinton. However, on the delegate count, Clinton is much closer than her rival to securing her party's nomination. The GOP's apparent nominee, Donald Trump, is already focusing on Clinton as the person he will face in the general election. Though Trump is the sole remaining candidate, Republican voters in West Virginia and Nebraska are still seeing the names of his former rivals on their ballots. NPR's Mara Liasson reports Trump has come out with policy proposals in recent days, though observers say his stance on any given issue remains in flux.
Trump seems to be changing his opinion on a number of issues, his tax plan, whether the minimum wage should be raised, on some comments he made about renegotiating the terms of the national debt. And he makes flexibility and changing his positions a virtue. He says, of course I am. You learn new things and you change. For most politicians, that would be called a flip-flop, and it's often fatal. But Donald Trump has a different set of rules that he plays by.
NPR's Mara Liasson. The man who has admitted to shooting three people to death at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado last November will return to court this afternoon. Ben Marcus of Colorado Public Radio says the court is trying to determine whether Robert Deere Jr. is mentally competent to stand trial.
The judge ordered a competency evaluation for Deere after he repeatedly interrupted proceedings with paranoid rantings, at one point accusing his public defenders of trying to keep him quiet about the supposed atrocities he saw at the clinic, which provides abortions. Two state doctors found Deere, who's 57, not mentally fit to stand trial, saying he suffers from a delusional disorder. He believes the FBI was intensely surveilling him and that agents broke into his house to cut holes in his clothes. But the district attorney is challenging that assessment, saying Deere is often calm and composed, and he clearly understands the charges against him. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
The Chinese government is admonishing the U.S. for sailing a Navy ship near disputed islands in the South China Sea. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that the U.S. maneuver comes at a delicate time.
The Pentagon says the guided missile destroyer USS William P. Lawrence came within 12 miles of Fiery Cross Reef in the Spratly Islands. The Philippines has filed suit against China over the islands at an international court in The Hague. A ruling is expected soon. The island is also claimed by Vietnam, which President Obama is set to visit later this month.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was up 190 points, more than 1%, at 17,896. S&P 500 up 20, NASDAQ also up 47 points. This is NPR News.
From the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald, I'm Christine DiMattei. Miami-Dade voters are not yet sold on Mayor Carlos Jimenez. They're split on medical marijuana and decidedly down on Donald Trump. Those are the headlines from a survey by WLRN, Ben Dixon and Amandi International, El Nuevo Herald, the Miami Herald, and Univision 23. WLRN's Rowan Moore Garrity has details.
600 Miami-Dade voters took part in the poll. Joseph Brennan says he's an independent who registered as a Republican this year specifically to vote against Donald Trump. Here's how he rates Carlos Jimenez's performance as county mayor.
A more than passable job.
Brennan says it's enough for Jimenez to earn his vote in the primary. As for his main competitor, Raquel Regalado.
Little experience, school board member, personal bankruptcy, no record of achievement.
Her big challenge right now is nearly half of the electorate just has no idea who she is.
That's Fernand Amandi, a partner at the firm that conducted the poll. On the whole, he says the survey suggests the county mayor's race remains wide open. Jimenez's approval ratings are below 50% across the board, and a third of voters in our survey remain undecided. If the presidential election were held tomorrow, Hillary Clinton would get more than double the votes of Donald Trump in Miami-Dade, including one out of five registered Republicans.
That's got to be a very scary sign for the Trump campaign.
Support for the medical marijuana initiative remains virtually unchanged since Miami-Dade voters narrowly rejected a similar measure in 2014. I'm Rowan Moore Garrity in Miami.
In other news today, a man charged with plotting to bomb an Aventura synagogue and school is seeking release on bail. A hearing is set today in Miami federal court for 40-year-old James Medina of Hollywood. The FBI says Medina plotted with an undercover informant to bomb the Aventura Turnberry Jewish Center during the recent Passover holiday. FBI recordings show Medina allegedly supported the Islamic State terrorist group and claimed an obligation to attack Jews in the United States. Medina faces life in prison if convicted of attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction. This is WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Christine DiMattei.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you on this Tuesday afternoon. Earlier, we played a billboard for our program, which was in error. We don't have psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner on today, nor Linda Gassenheimer, but we will be featuring those guests tomorrow.
No, Thursday.
Thursday, yes. Tomorrow's a school board meeting. Now we're all together. We're all on the same page.
Okay.
But today we delve into the rather uncharted territory, at least for most of us, of roboethics.
As robot usage becomes more widespread and certainly more sophisticated, questions pop up at many turns.
How about a robot that guards its own safety to the point of threatening humans?
Scary. Or think of a sophisticated robot that challenges the medical diagnosis of your doctor.
There could be many more similar situations.
So joining us now are two experts in the field, along with Ryan Kahlo, or Kahlo, is it?
Kahlo.
Kahlo. They edited the book Robot Law. First,
in the studio is University of Miami Professor A. Michael Frumkin. He's the founder of the We Robot Conference on legal and policy issues related to robots, and much more. Also with us by phone is Dr. Ian Kerr, the Canada Research Chair in Ethics, Law, and Technology at the University of Ottawa.
He's cross-appointed to the Faculty of Law and the Department of Philosophy, and I believe he joins us now. Dr. Kerr, are you there?
I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Great to have you.
And welcome to you, Professor A. Michael Frumkin, as well.
Thank you.
Welcome to you both. Professor Frumkin, we'll start with you. You say there's still not even a consensus regarding what constitutes a robot. So I thought we'd begin there. What counts, what is a robot? And do you and Dr. Kerr agree on what a robot is?
Boy, I'll let him speak for himself on his views. The controversy has to do with whether a robot has to have a body, right? So I think just about everybody who thinks in the academic world, at least, about robots agrees that robots have to have a few properties. They have to be able to sense things in the world. They have to be able to process what they sense and make some decision on the basis of that. And they have to be able to affect the world in some way. But that's the extent of the consensus, right? So what I've just described there includes a program trader on the stock market. But there's some people who'd say, no, something that's just pure software doesn't count as a robot. There's some people who'd say to be a robot, it has to have a body, it has to exist in space. And that's an important fourth characteristic of a robot. So that's why there's not a consensus.
Okay, Dr. Kerr, and your feeling about what a robot is?
Yes, well, as Professor Frumkin said, I mean, those are the chief characteristics. I think that there's questions about what is a robot, and then there's a question of what is a robot. And the second question is that some robots are uninteresting from a law policy perspective, right? A robot that can spot weld on a factory line doesn't tend to raise too many issues unless something goes awry. But where we're at now is a situation where more and more we're making robots and artificial intelligence programs that do unpredictable things. So whether that's characterized as so-called the autonomy that is given to the robot, or discretion, or the emergent characteristics, the idea is that sometimes now we set robots out into the world and we don't exactly know what they're going to do. And sometimes it's those robots, sometimes imbued with what we sometimes call intelligence, raises questions about what is interesting for law and policy.
Michael Frumpke, you teach a course at UM which tackles the topic of disruptive technology. What is that?
So disruptive technology is anything which is going to seriously change the way you live. It could be something that changes jobs and employment. It could be something that cuts out the intermediaries.
Or the legal framework?
Usually it's something that the legal framework is going to have to react to. Right. Law tends to be reactive. I mean, one of the reasons we actually started the We Robot conference is because law is too reactive to new technology in the ordinary course. And we want to try to get ahead of things a bit and plan a bit for a change. But generally speaking, a disruptive technology is one where people rush it to market, and it starts having all sorts of social effects of one kind or another. The internet was a major disruptive technology. Robots will be one, too.
I have this I think it's just something I don't understand. I'll ask you, Dr. Kerr, is everything about a robot programmed by a human, or do they have their capacity to think or act on their own?
Well, so, I mean, the idea is sometimes the parameters around the programming are such that the machine system is left to, in some cases, learn for itself what to do. And we've seen recent headlines of, for example, Facebook building AI to train AI. So that's another aspect of robotics that's interesting, which is often sort of talked about as a kind of self-replication. But that is one of the characteristics that will be the most challenging, which is when the programming is in some sense open-ended, and it isn't the robot is it's just not sensing and then reacting and doing one thing.
What set of laws would control robots? Would it be federal, or would there be state, or could there be municipal ordinances governing robots?
It totally depends on what kind of robot we're talking about.
We'll talk about a drone that's surveying.
So anything that's in space, that's in a place, like a self-driving car or a drone or something, it's going to definitely have a state law component. But the drone's also going to have a federal law component, because the FAA is asserting a lot of jurisdiction over drones. So that gets very complicated very quickly. With the cars, it's the DMV, but of course there are a lot of DMVs out there. So what happens when the car crosses the state line? And then for all the robots together, there's products liability law. Right?
Or a drone kidnaps or robs a bank or a post office.
So
we're not quite there yet.
Well, you sent this video, Professor Frumpkin, and the robot disobeys a command because it will result in self-harm if he followed it, right? He said the man tells him to walk forward and he's going to go off the table. But then the man assures him that he won't fall off the table. He's going to catch him. So he follows the command. So first of all, is that possible for a robot to think like that and say, no, I'm not going to follow that command? And secondly, what if the human doesn't keep his word and it results in harming the robot or a human being?
So I'm afraid I have to be real academic on you and unpack that question.
Because the
question whether the robot thinks is actually completely separate from the question of whether it can be programmed not to follow the command.
So we
could get there lots of different ways. Okay. We could get there by having the robot think and learn. We could get there just by programming in a particular way to do particular things. And that'll affect the answer to the other part of the question, which is what happens when the human betrays it.
Right.
Although it's really interesting that one of the things that happens that you might not expect is the human feels really guilty.
You've done studies on
that. I haven't, but colleagues have. Some of them are in the book. And people anthropomorphize robots. And actually, Ian knows more about this than I do. But they get very attached to them. And they start to treat them like pets or people even.
Dr. Kerr, your thoughts along those lines?
Yes. Well, one of the things that we're starting to see is that not only is there a natural tendency to anthropomorphize objects, in other words, for people to treat them as though they had human characteristics. But now there are fields of study which are designed around exploiting that human tendency so as to induce those kinds of reactions. So what is a field that is called anthropomorphic design and another related field that's called affective computing, where the idea is to either synthesize emotion in the machine system or, on the flip side, teach the machine system to recognize cues in its atmosphere for when emotion is being displayed by a human being so that it can react to that kind of thing.
Dr. Kerr, you mentioned the film Her in one of your emails when we were trying to get the pronunciation for your name. So you said you wanted to discuss it, and I really do. I saw the movie. Let's listen to this clip.
Mr. Theodore Twombly, welcome to the world's first artificially intelligent operating system. Please wait as your operating system is initiated.
Hello, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Samantha. Good morning, Theodore.
Good morning.
You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed?
You're too funny.
Okay, good, I'm funny. I want to learn everything about everything.
I love the way you look at the world.
Okay, so Dr. Kerr, it was, of course, written and directed by Spike Jones. Is that realistic, that Samantha has the ability to learn and grow psychologically? Is that realistic?
Well, first of all, I think that's the wrong question, actually. The question is it realistic to think that Theodore Twombly might imbue those characteristics on Samantha? Right, so that's this whole affective computing and anthropomorphic design that I'm talking about. So what we've learned since the time of Alan Turing, who said that a machine is intelligent if it can trick a human being into thinking that it's interacting with another human being, what we came to realize in people trying to build those systems was that people would do that themselves. So it's actually less about the question of whether there will be machine consciousness and more about the question of what characteristics are we willing to believe about those systems as we interoperate with them. I've been studying some of the early systems since around 2000. So now we're at the level of Siri, which everybody recognizes on their iPhones and people have chatted with. But prior to Siri, there was a bunch of chatbots which didn't have an actual voice, but instead were just texting on an instant messaging platform. And one chatbot called Elgirl Buddy, in one weekend of use, was told, "I love you," 8 million times by users. So we have this tendency to treat machine systems in ways that aren't necessarily appropriate for machines. And so it's not surprising to me that people would form physical, emotional, and eventually physical bonds with machine systems. It's not a coincidence that just a couple of months ago when we were having our We Robot conference in Miami, that a roboticist in Japan set out some video of a robot that he'd created from 3D printing for about $50,000, which was, it's called the Mark One, but it is the embodiment of Scarlett Johansson, this very same voice from the movie Her.
Well, and of course, the other voice we heard was of Joaquin Phoenix. And we are going to take a break. But wait, Professor Frumkin, you have something to add.
I just want to say that this tendency of people to behave this way is liable to be exploited, and is people are trying to exploit it, both in good ways and bad ways. So good ways might be psychotherapy. Bad ways might be police interrogations. And those are both on the drawing board.
Explain.
So you create a robotic interrogator that people become sympathetic to, that measures all your reactions and tailors its responses to your unconscious responses, your eyes dilating,
stress
sweating,
levels,
all kinds of things.
So you mean like a robotic lie detector machine in a way, or
a robot with a lie detector and more built in would be a better way to put it.
Okay.
And those are actually the study of one of the chapters in our Robot Law book, and is a study of a system that is being supported by funding from the Department of Homeland Security. So these things are not just about the movies.
Oh my. Okay, we're speaking about robots and robotic roboethics and robotics with Professor A. Michael Frumkin. He's University of Miami Distinguished Professor of Law and Program Chair for the We Robot 2016 Conference. He's co-editor of this book, as is Dr. Ian Kerr, who holds the Canada Research Chair in Ethics, Law, and Technology at the University of Ottawa, also holds cross appointments to the Faculty of Medicine, Department of Philosophy, and the School of Information Studies. Wow. Okay, I'm going to watch my questions after this. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
You can become a confident leader in your chosen field. St. Thomas University's new cutting-edge graduate programs are designed for fast acceleration to success. You can now get a top-notch private education at a cost you can afford with St. Thomas University's new graduate program, offering reduced tuition that includes books. Learn more at stu.edu/grad school. The Miami-Lisbon Dance Exchange brings together companies from Portugal with Florida's own Karen Peterson and dancers, integrating performers with and without disabilities. This Thursday and Friday at Miami-Dade County Auditorium. Tickets in advance through Ticketmaster. We're funded by WLRN members and by Sofer Vein, specializing in the treatment that eliminates varicose veins which cause tired, achy, cramping, and restless legs. Most insurance is accepted. More at soferhealth.com or 866-963-VEIN.
And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation about robots and roboethics with University of Miami Law Professor A. Michael Frumkin and also Dr. Ian Kerr, the Canada Research Chair in Ethics, Law, and Technology at the University of Ottawa. Gentlemen, both of you, your views about robotics and medicine, particularly in the ethical area, particularly our question that we began with the beginning, the medical diagnosis of your doctor, and what if a robot challenges that diagnosis, or if your doctor doesn't use a robot, is there a malpractice claim there? Dr. Kerr?
Sure. So these are questions which we're actually starting to see insofar as systems like IBM Watson, who gained fame at winning the game, beating all the humans in Jeopardy, very quickly was being trained towards medical diagnosis in cancer over the last couple of years. And a Wired magazine headline recently stated that Watson was now better than medical doctors at predicting various forms of cancer. So in my chapter in the book, one of the questions that I raise is, I'm imagining the ethical dilemma that the doctor faces in a situation where the doctor is, you know, the primary responsible physician on the file. The doctor, let's say in a certain instance, has a disagreement with the machine system, but the machine system, let's say, has a better track record in terms of predicting results. Mm. The doctor then sits in a situation where, rationally speaking, there might be reasons or empirical basis for following what the machine system said, but on the other hand, the doctor disagrees. I suggest that this is, in a sense, like that moment where Abraham feels the angst on the mountain, hearing the voice but not knowing what to do. At the end of the day, we see that the doctor is the decision maker and is embarked and must decide. I think, you know, Professor Frumkin and I have had disagreements over time in thinking through some of these examples in terms of liability, but certainly from an ethical perspective, it's going to be an uncomfortable position if we get to that position. It may be the case that from the perspective of medical standards like the standard of care, that following the robot might be seen as perfectly valid within the context of practice. But it might be an uncomfortable decision for the doctor to make the first time, knowing that if they follow the robot and the robot was wrong and the doctor was right, what some of the sort of perceptions and repercussions will be.
Professor Frumkin, you wanted to add something?
Well, I'd say two things. First is that this Watson thing, one of the difficulties with working with Watson is Watson can't give you reasons. Watson gives you answers that are based on big correlations. So you can't really inquire either of Watson or in any diagnostic faction of Watson why it thinks what it thinks. It just tells you the answer, and you sort of look at that, and what do you make with it? And that's a real difficult problem. It's not how we're used to dealing with, say, two doctors disagreeing, where they might actually have a debate. And the other thing is that imagine you're the hospital administrator, And the and the doctor says one thing, and Watson says the other, and Watson's got a 10% better batting average. Pretty quickly, I mean, I don't know, but the first case is going to be terribly hard. But from a legal matter, unless we change the law under current law, pretty quickly, the robot's going to win those debates.
Do robots have, like they're using robotics to do surgery? Is that all determined by the doctor? He's moving. I mean, the robot has no autonomy, does it?
Today, almost all robotic surgery is under the very close control of the doctor, but that's not what's on the drawing board.
What is on the drawing board?
On the drawing board is things, for example, we had a presentation where the conference says people are thinking of trying to build military applications where you don't bring a doctor to the front with you, but you bring a machine that can do first aid. And it has to have a lot of autonomy because it can't phone home because the bad guys might be degrading the communications. So it's got to be able to work even when the communications channel is being jammed. So that may be one of the early adopters would be the military.
Well, as far as the military, let's talk about intentionally lethal robots, of course, which would be used in war. But how could that be then skewed in torture? It would probably make Room 101 look like a picnic if this robot could torture you.
So, robots are a tool like a car, right, or a refrigerator. You can do anything. You can store, deadly toxins in a fridge. You can store a sandwich in a fridge. And it's the same thing. When I worry about armed robots, I worry a lot more about their domestic use, about the just so we militarized our police and gave them tanks and AK-47s, pretty stuff that's the military stuff trickles down to first the border patrol. Oh, we'll just taser people coming over the wall. And next thing you know, they're shooting. And next thing you know, it's demonstrators. And I would very strongly support a ban on militarizing all robots. And there are people trying to get an international convention for that, but it's not going to – doesn't seem that likely.
Right, because if it falls into – unscrupulous hands or whatever, that could be
chemical warfare was ruled out, and yet they've been made, of course, and used.
Well, if I can jump in here, so sure. That's an issue that I've been dealing quite squarely with and been involved with the discussions at the UN. And while I do think it is an uphill battle, I like to leave a bit of optimism or at least the space for those kinds of decisions on the table, because the Convention on Conventional Weapons, which is a group that meets a couple times a year at the United Nations, recently decided to make some space on their agenda to really study this issue. And one of the things that's interesting about this issue and that I worry about actually is something that was expressed rather nicely by Michael in talking about these robots being used in sort of a first aid health setting, but in military space, and that is that the impetus will be things like the fact that communication systems can be jammed,
right,
and therefore you need to program the machine to carry out its mission on its own. That may sound like a noble thing in the context of doing first aid, but when it's about delegating the kill decision to a machine system, where we're now crossing a fundamental moral line about who gets to decide about intentional killings, it becomes much more problematic in a way that Michael, I think, also expressed in expressing support for a ban. But one of the things that I think is really interesting when we ask all of these questions is that we boil it down to the question about which kinds of human activities and decision-making ought we to delegate to machine systems, mm-hmm. so that the human is now removed from the decision loop.
Well, who determines that?
Well, I guess we as a society will determine it to some extent that we allow, we have a say in any democratic system to some extent in at least voicing what our concerns are at the level, whether it's at the level of the United Nations, but also certainly for things like as we think about driverless vehicles, as we think about robotic surgeons, et cetera, we're going to have to think really hard about what the differences are in these scenarios and why those differences matter when we make different policy decisions about the sort of permissible use of those machines.
Professor Pumpkin?
So I agree with everything that Ian Kerr just said, but I just want to take it one step further. At the most recent robot conference, we had a marvelous speech by an anthropologist about this human-in-the-loop problem, because that's been the answer in a lot of robotics, right? Is we put a human in the loop, so we don't let the robot make the final decision, and the human can either abort or has to say yes. And she talked about what she called moral crumple zones. The idea is you put a human in a loop, but in a system which is designed the way the human doesn't have enough information or time, right, to make a really sensible decision. And then when things go wrong, you blame the human. And apparently this is what has happened in a number of technology-based disasters, including some nuclear power plants, airplane crashes, and so on. And it made me realize that when we talk about designing robots and this question of, you know, how we should design, we're not just talking about designing a piece of machinery. It's a system that includes people in which the robot is embedded. You have to design the whole system.
Well, should the legal, on a robot, should the legal extension be to those who control them as far as the legal weight?
Well, that's the easy answer if they really control it. But what do we do about the robots that learn, that have emergent behavior, that do unpredictable things?
And adapt.
That's right. Now we have a really, the example I like to give is you get a robot to help you with your housework, and you set it to go cut the lawn while you're at work, and your next-door neighbor's bored. So he teaches the robot to do, you know, stupid robot tricks. And the mailman comes along, and the robot wants to demonstrate a stupid robot trick and injures the mailman. Now, who are you going to blame? You're going to blame the neighbor, you, the owner, the manufacturer, the programmer, the mailman, you know, who's to blame in that story?
Do robots have privacy? Do they have rights?
Not at present.
Let me, I have a general question for each
except,
of you.
Except in one small way, which is that like any property, right, if I try to blow up your car, you're going to have a claim against me. So in that sort of sense, the car has a right not to be blown up.
Okay.
And it's the same thing with a robot as a piece of property.
But just in general, all the stuff we're talking about, given the pace of innovation and the growth of technology, how are you going to keep up with these issues? Because as we're talking about things, as soon as you successfully address one set of issues from a philosophical, legal, ethical standpoint, it's going to change, and there's going to be a whole new set. It could be 10 minutes from now, or a year from now, or a month from now, or whenever.
So I've got two great advantages. I've got Ian's phone number, and he's a one-man interdisciplinary committee.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons we designed this conference, is to bring people together from a whole bunch of different disciplines, because these problems are too hard for just engineers or just
lawyers. Is it more difficult now than at the beginning of the internet?
A little bit, I think, because there are more actors. Robots are more complicated because you've got every state DMV involved, because robots are physical. So you've got a whole bunch of local actors as well as national and international actors. And the stakes are in some ways higher because there's a danger of physical harm, which was relatively rare with the internet. Not non-existent, but relatively rare.
If I could jump in, the other thing that I would add that we are starting to see here is, I think in the early days of deciding about how to regulate certain things on the internet, we were very interested, as we still are in some contexts, in this notion of what people who do what we do call technological neutrality, where the idea is you design the regulatory system based on certain principles so that those principles apply regardless of whether you're talking about drones mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever. And so privacy is a space, for example, you know, questions about information collection, use and dissemination. It doesn't necessarily matter if it's a robot collecting that or if it's a CCTV camera, et cetera, et cetera. But what I think we are recognizing more and more with a lot of the devices, some of which are robots and AI related, but not necessarily, is that we are seeing circumstances or situations where we need what we might call more sector-specific approaches, where it can't just be this set of neutral principles that applies across the board.
Professor, you want to add something on that?
Well, that's been the pattern in a lot of technologies. Like we have the FCC, you know, to deal with TV and radio and so on. We have the Interstate Commerce Commission to deal with railroads. There have been proposals for a National Robotics Commission, and that may come in time. I'm not quite sure where they're yet, but that may come soon.
We're speaking about robots, ethics of robots, legality, law, whatever, on today's Topical Currents with Professor A. Michael Frumkin from U of M and Dr. Ian Kerr from the University of Ottawa. A short break, and we'll be right back.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Miami Light Project's signature program Here and Now is back May 12th through 21st at the Lightbox at Goldman Warehouse, currently celebrating the 18th year of what's been called a one-of-a-kind program. Here and Now 2016 features newly commissioned short work from Miami's most exciting time-based artists who are working across disciplines to define contemporary performance in Miami. You won't want to miss Here and Now. Tickets at MiamiLightProject.com.
You can earn a Sunshine Certificate in Nonprofit Management. Florida Association of Nonprofits offers classes for the growth of nonprofit executives. All certificates are earned in cooperation with Nova Southeastern University and Broward College. More at fano.org.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Hale, Shaw, and Pfaffenberger, dedicated to providing a deep understanding of legal issues and personal attention to make you feel comfortable and secure in the legal process. HaleShaw.com. Hale, Shaw, and Pfaffenberger. When legal matters.
And we return 36 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we're speaking with University of Miami Law Professor A. Michael Frumkin and Dr. Ian Kerr, the Canada Research Chair in Ethics, Law, and Technology at the University of Ottawa. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, that's easy enough. Our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or email, perhaps a little quicker, radio@WLRN.com.
And of course, what we were listening to as we went out of our segment was Open the Pod Door. It was from Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And of course, HAL was the computer. And what were you saying, Professor Frumkin, about that?
When I had my first PC, I programmed the error message. So it would say, I'm sorry, Frank, I can't do that. But it drove my office mate crazy, actually.
I can imagine why. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576.
We've broached a little bit on the history of this, but this goes back to also to Isaac Asimov's rules in 1942. Could you explain that?
So the three laws of robotics, which Isaac Asimov invented, were that I'll probably misquote this from memory, but that a robot can't injure a human being, that a robot has to follow any orders given to it by a human being as long as it doesn't conflict with the first law. And the third law is the robot has to protect itself as long as it doesn't conflict with the first two laws.
Which seems to kind of solve a lot of problems then.
Well, it's one thing to write the rules. It's quite another thing to instantiate them.
Right.
And again, actually, you go back to the thing we mentioned earlier about when robots need to say no. That's asking the robot sometimes to make very subtle judgments about what will harm a person or not. So if we have a robot that's involved in elder care, which is huge in Japan, and one of the things the robot's supposed to do is dispense medicine, and you have maybe a forgetful patient who says, give me my meds, and the robot does so, and then 20 minutes later it says, give me my meds, mm-hmm. The robot has to know it can't. Now that's a relatively simple calculation, but you can imagine a lot more complicated decisions. I'd like to go out now. Can I cradle my toaster in the bathtub? Whatever the question might be.
Or if they have Alzheimer's.
Where you'd be asking potentially the robot to make very complex decisions. And that's tough.
And you're saying this is being used now in Japan?
Well, the robots are popular in elder care, but mostly as sort of more comfort therapy applications than in anything like what we're doing.
Like emotional support, well, like an animal?
Well, like someone to talk to.
Oh, my gosh.
We've had experiments in this country too, but most likely with robotic animals. There's a famous one of a seal, for example, a little robotic seal.
So, can we talk about ethics, like teaching a computer right and wrong? Is that something that they can learn?
Ian?
Sure. So I think we have to be really careful, and certainly there are people who are working on those very topics now, and that is exactly how they would describe it. But I think, in a sense, the idea of I'm imagining Aristotle, who said that human beings weren't fit to study ethics until they reached the age of 30 because they didn't have enough life experience, rolling over, hearing about these discussions. So I think we have to be very careful to distinguish between a machine system complying with a rule, mm-hmm. or carrying out, having rule-following behavior, versus actually following the rule in the sense that it had ethical understanding and knowledge and the ability to apply wisdom to a particular situation in order to to do the right thing. But certainly many people are suggesting that we need to at least imbue the machine system with enough smarts, so to speak, that it can make these sophisticated outcomes of the sort that Michael was just describing, where it knows at least at some basic level when to obey or not obey.
And if I could just complicate that even a bit more.
Thank you.
The way I prefer to think about the question, and again, I'm not one of the people who does these studies, so I'm not one of the people who uses those terms, but is what ethical rules are going to drive the people who write the programs?
That's
what goals they're going to try to give it. So, for example, when people worry about self-driving cars, they have all these hypotheticals of, should you program the car to kill the occupant or the five pedestrians?
Oh, the same.
What choices are you making? Should always be the choice. Should one person in one of the conferences suggested you should give the driver a quiz to find out their driving style and then just try to mimic it. That would be really great in Miami. And another version, another level that makes this even more complicated is that being human beings, we bring a lot of unconscious biases to the table. And the things we consider relevant or interesting or want to program in may have blind spots in them. And what's more, just to make it even worse than that, to the extent we're using Watson-like systems or anything that's built on data sets, the data sets can have unconscious biases built into them. So what constitutes a threat might well be something that has some bias built into it, racism or other things.
Right.
It gets very, very difficult, very complicated, very sticky, very fast.
Well, I'll take a call.
Yeah.
Our number 1-800-743-9576 if you'd like to join in. Jesus in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks. It's great to be here. My question is, robots so far today can only do repetitive work, such as working in factories. They're not creative, such as their ability to create movies, art, and so forth. So my question is it probable that they can have that ability in the next 100 years?
Oh.
I think you're kind of downplaying
it. I think you have to go say in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
You've got robots writing poetry, writing books, making paintings in the style of Rembrandt, leading to terrible questions.
On their own?
On the own, in the sense, once you turn them on. I mean, on the own, somebody programmed them to do it. In the Rembrandt, they showed them lots of Rembrandts and said, make something in the style of these things. So on your own is a funny term, right? But I mean, but once it's turned on, free from further human input. And then the question is, who owns the copyright?
Okay, Jesus.
We've temporarily lost Dr. Kerr, but we're getting him back. Right?
Okay. So in describing robot law, Professor Frumkin, you write that robots have great potential to take on an unpleasant, difficult, or boring task, but they also present real risks that require careful planning by designers and policymakers, which confuses me because it seems that they're being created in this vacuum as opposed to being created by human beings. Isn't anyone in charge of the human beings that are creating these policies and...
Well, yes and no. It depends, again, by anyone. I mean, so in the United States, right, things are permitted unless they're forbidden. So you want to create a startup and build a robot, you can go do that unless you're going to violate, zoning law or some other law or traffic law if you try to drive it on the street and so on. But the idea of just having a robot, there's no law that says you can't have a robot and program it to do stuff. It's just certain things you can't do with or without a robot or sometimes with a machine. It's very circumstance-specific. But the general rule in this country is you can, experiment and build stuff and sell it, and that's the story of Silicon Valley.
Well, what are the economics of all this robot stuff? I'm thinking it must be huge.
It's growing really incredibly fast. I mean, in the 5 years we've been doing this conference, the amount of money in the sector has just gone up exponentially.
Like, from where to where?
I don't have the numbers in my head.
Okay.
I'm not an investor. Actually, one of the interesting things about this is, I tried to be an investor. I thought about it. So a lot of the robotics is a funny thing because, first of all, a lot of the companies are small and privately owned, and a lot of the others are really big, like Google or Siemens or something. They have a robots division. There's not that many in between, partly because the big guys have been buying stuff up like crazy. And the other thing about the space is there's this problem, it's a very technical problem, called a patent thicket. And what happens is there's some key patents that are owned by particular people, and it can be quite tough to design around them for some of the areas.
Dr. Kerr, what do you think is the next biggest development in this nature?
Well, I'm sort of very interested in the growing merger between artificial intelligence and robotic technologies. So what we've sort of seen, I mean, I think if you talk to enough roboticists, you get a real sense that, you know, the stuff of movies is the stuff of movies. And the reason is because it's actually very hard to solve the technical problems. But where we're starting to see, you know, pretty significant progress is on the AI side, which for a while sort of stood more still. But with recent things like, it was well covered in the media, but when the system that played the game Go and beat the human champions of Go, it was very interesting to watch, because here were these machine systems that were not just outperforming what their programmers had hoped for, which is always a good thing, but were actually performing in ways that their programmers couldn't really explain. Why did it make that move? And there's been lots of discussion around that. So to me, once we start to think of the AI applications where they have embodiment and where they have effectors in the real world, those to me are some of the things to watch out for. Obviously, the technologies that are getting the most attention these days, because they're actually near-term or at least mid-term, is things like driverless vehicles, which would obviously combine some levels of AI and programming with the hardware, and military robots as well.
The FAA says there'll be 7 million drones in the air in the United States in the next 5 years.
And are they going to be monitored by air traffic?
Not at present. I mean, they have to register if they're heavier than a stick of butter. But currently air traffic control isn't involved. I mean, there are a whole bunch of questions about should they be allowed to fly over your house? If they fly over the roads, how do we keep them from bumping into each other and falling down and hitting the cars?
So do I control my own airspace?
Well, I've just read an article with a former student in which we argued that you ought to be able to, at least up to where the FAA's airspace starts.
Right.
And you ought to have a right to exclude drones. And that's actually in everybody's interest, we argue, because it protects your privacy.
So I can have an anti-aircraft gun.
No. Shooting projectiles into the air is probably a really lousy idea in any urban area. The police take a pretty dim view of that generally, and for good reasons.
So if somebody went to shoot down a drone
in
that
rural
was
Wyoming,
hovering
maybe.
Over there. Yeah, right. But if there was one hovering outside your window, you know, for some unscrupulous activity, you have no right to shoot it down?
Well, you may have a right in tort, but the question is, would there be a criminal law consequences for firing the weapon?
What about stand your ground laws in Florida? All right, we're speaking about robots with Professor A. Michael Frumkin of University of Miami, Distinguished Professor of Law, and Dr. Ian Kerr, Canada Research Chair in Ethics, Law, and Technology at the University of Ottawa. Short break. We'll come back and take your calls.
We're funded by WLRM members and by Willie the Bee Man. Proper bee removal requires two steps, locating the hive and extracting the honeycomb. Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialists, offers complete beehive removal. Details at 1-855-466-BEES.
At Deering Estates Summer Camp, children can explore the best that nature has to offer through outdoor activities for eco-explorers ages 6 to 8 and Expedition Deering for ages 9 to 14. Details at deeringestate.org.
Healthcare prices are complicated. However you pay for your healthcare, WLRN has an online guide called Price Check. It's a database of prices for common healthcare procedures and medical supplies. You can add your prices to the list, and we're asking for your help building the database. The more people who add their prices, the more useful the guide becomes. Price Check is a community-created database of healthcare prices. You can find it at wlrn.org/pricecheck.
Goodness! Han Solo! It is I, C-3PO. BB-8, you're wasting your time. I am afraid not. R2-D2 has been in low power mode ever since Master Luke went away. R2-D2, you've come back.
Topical currents.
And we're speaking with University of Miami Law Professor A. Michael Frumkin. Also from the University of Ottawa, Dr. Ian Kerr. We're talking about robots and roboethics. Professor Frumkin, we were talking during the break. What happens if a robot is your supervisor at work?
For me, the question is more about what happens to your job.
Right.
So you're about your supervisor. I mean,
losing it too, of course.
Right. So, you know, every single time we've had a major leap in automation in this country or in the world, people come out and predict about it's going to kill employment and, you know, going to have mass unemployment lines and so on. It's never happened yet. So I have to say, I look at all those predictions with a grain of salt. But there is one thing that is a little bit different about robots from some of the past waves of automation. And that is that they're much more able to do, instead of just doing physical jobs, they can also do jobs that are mental jobs that have traditionally been done by professionals. I saw a headline yesterday on the internet about how a law firm has just contracted with IBM to employ Watson to help it analyze bankruptcy filings. So it's not just the doctors, it's the lawyers too. Now that's serious.
Now that's serious. That's because right. They're so, stepping on your toes.
I work in law school, right, so that's serious.
Well, what about this that Polly Landis just brought in? Will the new socially assistive robot from MIT Media Lab or its progeny replace teachers?
Or the headline from yesterday, which is artificial intelligence course creates AI teaching assistants, and the subheadline is the students didn't know that their TA was a computer.
Oh, I got to read that.
That's good. You want to take that?
Okay, let's take another call. We've got Jason in Sunrise. Jason, you're up.
Yeah, hi. I had a question. What if a robot was reprogrammed in some sort of way at home to get involved in a criminal activity or, be of use for their criminal mastermind?
So it's just like any other tool, right? The person who does the reprogramming is going to be responsible for that.
If you use dynamite.
You know, it's like if you steal a car or if you reprogram somebody's computer now to steal their passwords.
All right, so just as a tool. All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jason.
Right.
The place where robots stop being legally obviously just like tools, again, is where they have emergent behavior, where they do unpredictable things. It's not complicated for lawyers or policymakers to say you're responsible for the things you reasonably foresaw that actually happened. Right? That's the ordinary rule of responsibility. The trouble is, what if you didn't reasonably foresee it? And by the way, that's a more general problem with robots overall. So take robot self-driving cars, for example. I don't know if you saw the thing in the news a while ago where the Google car had its first accident, got hit, you know, a low-speed crash with a bus. Apparently what happened is that the car didn't behave. It was more cautious than a human driver would have been. So it didn't meet expectations. So it turns out that when you have robots that have different capabilities from people, part of the human-robot interaction challenge is programming them to meet people's expectations about how things behave, which means either you got to train the people about how...
You mean in Miami, for example, they
have to run
train
red lights
them to
all the time.
Run
yeah.
red lights.
Absolutely.
Don't use turn signals.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'd like to ask each of you how you got into this field of robotics, beginning with you, Dr. Kerr.
Sure. I got into this field before the turn of the new millennium, when a government agency in Canada asked me to answer the question, can a computer enter into a contract? And this was an important question at the time because we were just starting to get into the automation of electronic commerce. And you may have to think back really hard to that first transaction you did where you sent the email or you clicked on the button and you got an automatic reply. And it's like, there's no way somebody has processed my order that quickly. And it's, of course, because it was an automated transaction. So we needed to come up with a set of rules that accounted for the situations where when people contract through the device of a computer, those contracts are held to be enforceable. And in certain situations, if there were some, when they weren't. So I started thinking about it, I guess, in 1998, trying to answer that set of questions.
So I came into it a bit later than Ian. My early part of my career was spent mostly worrying about the internet and about all the policy mistakes we made in designing the internet. Like the domain name system was designed in a way which creates terrible problems for trademark law. It has too much centralization, so it's a single point of failure. And so on. Tons of mistakes we made because we weren't thinking ahead. And when I started reading people like my co-editors, Ryan Kahlo and Ian Kerr's work about robots, I thought, wait a minute, I've seen this movie before. The same kind of mistakes are likely to happen. Couldn't we take... you know, the bruises and the lessons we had from the internet and do a better job with the robots.
Can you?
We're trying.
Michael Frumkin, tell us more about the We Robot conferences, and perhaps some of our listeners would like to go to one of them.
So these are really exciting events. We had the first one here in Miami 5 years ago. It's been peripatetic. So it's been on an East Coast, West Coast cycle so far. So we had one at the University of Washington, another back here, one at Stanford. I think I got the order wrong there. Back here just a few weeks ago. Next one's going to be at Yale. And we'll either come back here or go to the West Coast and then come back here after that. But you know you're doing well in academic circles when Yale invites you to do your show there.
Right.
And you know you're doing well in robot circles when people from all around the world start coming to your conference. And the last conference was amazingly international.
And how many people?
So it's about 150 at the last one.
But so these are really the leading figures, cutting edge.
Yeah, this is a very academic conference, right? This isn't a trade show.
Right.
These are people who are really trying to think ahead. And what's especially exciting to me is that it is in no way dominated by people from any one profession. So it's not dominated by lawyers or engineers or ethicists or philosophers or the military or the psychologists or the human-robot interaction people or any of the other groups. It's a real conversation between people who know a lot of different things. I mean, our lead-off speaker is an anthropologist. And we're really teaching each other. It's been what's so good for me.
And what about this Jotwell? I see you're the founder and editor-in-chief of Jotwell, the Journal of Things We Like Lots.
Yeah, that's got nothing to do with robots.
It doesn't?
The idea there is that lawyers tend to be very good at being negative and explaining what's wrong with stuff. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if people would tell me what I ought to be reading? So I started a journal where I've got 300 of the top lawyers from really around the world now, right, once a year, about the most interesting thing they've read that was written recently in their field and why you ought to want to read it. About 1,000 words usually. We publish 5 times a week, one article, from all different kinds of subjects. And it's kind of like a New York Review of books for lawyers.
And if I could just make a editorial comment as somebody from Canada, the amount of sort of attention on the global stage that has come to the University of Miami's Faculty of Law because of these two initiatives that Professor Frumkin has engaged in is just a feather in its cap. It's just when we think of WeRobot, we think of Miami. When I think of Jotwell, I think of Professor Frumkin. And these are the kinds of initiatives, you know, that Miami should be proud of. And I know he's going to kill me for saying that, but it needed to be said.
Just wait.
And you're both, of course, on the part of the editing of the book Robot Law.
That's right.
Along with
Ryan Kahlo.
And
University of Washington.
Dr. Kerr, just one other question for you. You have cross appointments to the Faculty of Medicine, Philosophy, and the School of Information Studies.
When do you sleep?
Yeah. I'm just interested how you went transversed all those fields. And
sure. Well, I mean, I think the link between all of those different units is technology, which is what both Professor Frumkin and I study the legal and social implications of. So really what, you know, I'm, I guess, in a sense, an instantiation of what I think we're seeing with the field in general, which is that it has to not only cross disciplinary boundaries, but in fact, to some extent, erase those boundaries and have a conversation where the people from traditionally those different boundaries come together and really solve the problems.
Well, we want to thank you both, Professor Michael Frumkin, University of Miami Distinguished Law Professor of Law at U of M, and Dr. Ian Kerr, the Canada Research Chair in Ethics, Law, and Technology. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. It was produced by Polly Landis, technical direction from Jason Zabka, our lead producer Richard Ives, online credits to Paul Leary. It's easy to get free audio archives of topical currents at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. We return Thursday with another topical currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.